top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
And now for a look at the local news. Rubbish collectors on the north side had an unpleasant surprise this morning when one of the containers they were collecting proved to be holding the remnants of a local woman who apparently had been mutilated and dismembered with a power saw.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 287, Lucio Fulci's Touch of Death.
Touch of Death. Now, this is not a Shaw Brothers movie, although it sounds like it would be.
Oh, yes.
Sure. or the infamous episode on The Simpsons where Bart learned the touch of death and threatened Lisa for the entirety of the episode.
Or Orson Welles' Touch of Evil.
I
kept forgetting the title of this movie as we were going to podcast it. And I kept having to remind myself, what is this thing called, as I did some research.
But... Well, because there's a lot of death in this movie, but mm-hmm. there's very little touching resulting in death. There's lots of implements used to cause shuffling off this mortal coil, there's ovens, there's machetes, there's what have you, but there's no real touch of death in the movie.
No.
Although the movie does have a veneer of death, so if you want to call that a touch of death, so be it. Now, we mentioned this is Lucio Fulci, of course, and we've made no bones about it on the podcast. We love Lucio Fulci, Zombie, The Beyond, Gates of Hell, what have you. These are all movies that came out in his golden period, which was very brief. It was almost like a supernova. It started off in 1979 with the aforementioned Zombie and ended arguably in 82 with New York Ripper, a movie that some people say is part of his golden period. Others say is the beginning of his decline.
And included there, he threw in City of the Living Dead, which I can't find and yet which I own. So I'm going to be
Gates
like,
of Hell. City
okay,
of the Dead.
Okay, Gates of Hell, which I'll be tearing apart my apartment to find this bloody thing, but... Yeah,
that's not my copy that you have, is it?
yes, I lost it, in air quotes. No, it's mine, and I miss it dearly. I've been doing some stuff over at my apartment, and can't find the thing, and I wanted to watch it yesterday, actually, to get on a bit of a Fulci binge.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not what would be included, again, in this is more of a, not even platinum, this would be maybe a tin period for Fulci.
Almost cardboard, I would say.
Okay, yeah, it was followed by Cat in the Brain, and this one is really like an episodic, loosely connected vignettes surrounding this womanizing maniac, as they describe him.
The maniac himself,
who goes just on a killing spree and speaks to his alter ego through the radio. And there's really not much other than that to this plot.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned Cat in the Brain, because what Cat in the Brain really is sort of like Fulci's meta-commentary on himself and his career, where he plays himself, and he's beset with these nightmares, and he's wondering, why am I so obsessed with these themes, with the misogyny, brutality, sanguinity, what have you, and interspersed to show these nightmares are clips from a whole bunch of his movies, six, I believe, in total. The one most prominently featured is Touch of Death. So that Cat in the Brain really is, in my opinion, Lucio Fulci's cardboard period's greatest hits.
And Brett Halsey is featured in both, and he's not really best known for anything because we looked him up, but he was in
Young and the Restless
and
well,
several
something.
Episodes. It is something. It's something rather than nothing. And some Dukes of Hazzard episodes. But he cuts.
Well, that's really something.
It is. Them Duke boys were in a lot of trouble. Yeah, he cuts an interesting figure here because this is kind of an introspective role where you see more of the killer than anyone else, and sort of his, not even torment, I don't know what it is, well, with respect to his gambling debts that he's accrued, but other than that, It's just him going about his business, doing what maniacs do,
mm-hmm.
and ridding the countryside of some of the middle-aged dames in the area. I don't know how to describe
well,
it.
Well, I mean, it's interesting
ingenues?
Because...
I don't know.
Ingenues, I mean, I hate to say it, but each one of his victims was more unattractive than the one before. And that was something that I think also didn't sit well with some of Lucio Fulci's critics, the ones that accused him of misogyny. But one thing this film lacks is any sort of prologue, any sort of sense of who is this guy? Why is he doing what he's doing? What makes him tick? When the film begins, you get a very unsteady cam take us into this guy's apartment as he's listening to horse racing results. Meanwhile, in his basement is one of his victims.
Yeah, and this set piece is one for the ages, because rare in a movie will you see someone being hacked to bits with a chainsaw before the opening credits have rolled. So I believe this is like...
You don't
a
even
minute.
See that in Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
No.
Really.
This is, what, a minute and 30 in, and
yep.
you get this... Yeah, well, I would say she's the most attractive one of the bunch. A young model trussed up in the basement,
mm-hmm.
gets her limbs lopped off, and she's savaged beyond... recognition.
Yep,
and
not to mention there's a hunk of her thigh that's missing, which he's a cannibal too.
Oh yeah, of course. And this enters some H.G. Lewis territory,
mm-hmm.
because he's got a bunch of body parts that he just feeds the pigs and eats himself. But even that they don't really touch on later. It's a I don't want to say it. Okay, it's a throwaway. It's a throwaway component. And so he feeds the slop to the pigs, and then never is the question of cannibalism addressed, I don't think at all, for the rest of the film.
That is quite true.
And his
yep.
M.O. changes throughout the film, apart from, I guess, seducing and bedding a bunch of these society women of varying degrees of attractiveness. But there's no real connecting thread to his... It's not like the Black Bluff Killer M.O. It's just this guy with a bottle of wine and whatever.
Yeah, a bit of an aging Lothario, yeah. No, but what he's doing is he's trying to find, through the personal ads, divorcees, widowers, etc., that are of means, because he's a man of debt. He's a man who's racked up a lot of debt in horse racing. He's racked up a lot of debt in card games.
Yes. And I believe one of his first victims, he tries to pawn her jewelry, but then realizes that it's...
Costume.
Yeah, it's ersatz, whatever, fugazi. Yeah, that's the word, right? And so, yeah, that, I guess that is, but even that is dropped immediately. So he doesn't attempt to, I guess, do that ever again. It's just shown once. He amasses, if I'm not mistaken, hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt to this local sleazy bookie, and tries to get it back by engaging in these different card games and stuff, but it really is not happening for him, and he keeps repeating the same, I guess, mistake over and over again, and that being not finding victims of means enough that they're able to just have on their person a bunch of stuff he can hawk. So it was really weird. Like,
well, it is bizarre. I mean, you meet somebody for the first time through the personal ads. You're going to bring over like $500,000 and you're going to wear the crown jewels when you come over? I don't think
I'm not sure, but I can't remember whose homestead they were at. I guess a couple of them were at his and some maybe at the victim's.
Mm-hmm.
And his connection to them is tenuous, to say the least. In one instance, there's like a missed dial and he gets the call, I believe. And it was maybe one of many... of this woman's gentleman callers that she mistakes him for someone else. I don't know, but yeah, he goes through the personal ads, procures this woman who's like Barnum and Bailey style, because she's like a bearded lady, and she also has like these unsightly moles by her nipples. So she's really quite hideous, and that's played for kicks too, because
yeah,
he's trying to poison her with a drink, and it's very like Princess Bride, where he's trying to get her to drink the poison, and she's flipping the two
drinks around.
He doesn't know which is which.
And then he offers her some sodium bicarbonate, which...
I think so, to soothe her aching
tummy.
And then he just gets sick to death of it, grabs a walking stick, I believe, and beats her brains in, and resulting in this fabulous Fulci-esque, well, as it should be.
Wait, yeah, considering it's directed by Lucio Fulci, but yeah.
What is it?
Ocular trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. And fabulous death right there. So there are touches, pardon the pun, throughout the movie of the, what Fulci's known for, which
now,
is this insane gore.
Is that the victim they ended up putting into the oven and melting her face off like a bloody crayon?
I believe so, because she unbelievably survive this trauma. And there's a couple instances where victims survive the most intense, incredible traumas to the face and upper torso, and she should not have survived with this over the top, what the police investigators call overkill. She is beaten to a bloody pulp and her eye is outside of her head, and yet she's still able to crawl around and try and escape her confines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, microwave massacre, a little call out to that one. So here I would argue that she would already have been pretty much dead. So this was just the coup de grace.
Oh, it was
so,
like, it's like, it was like a dead parrot sketch of Monty Python.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And it's deceased. Oh, that was a great, it's kicking piece. Up, kicking up daisies. It's come on, Chris. You could quote us some Monty Python.
He's stone dead. Yeah.
So as he's going about this, his MO or lack thereof,
yeah,
he keeps hearing things on the radio, which and on TV as well, because the city is in a tizzy over who is this killer, who is this maniac. And it's bizarre because the radio is communicating directly to him.
Yeah, and but it's not really developed, because the denouement touches on this but mm-hmm. doesn't address it. All it is an alter ego, and big deal. So many killers in the pantheon of horror have alter egos and dual personalities.
Dual personalities,
look at
voices.
Norman Bates.
Yep.
But really, it's not developed whatsoever, and that's the theme throughout this movie, if there is one, is something that's introduced and not really developed. Cannibalism, yes, sure. A certain type of weapon dropped, and then he uses about five or six weapons, mm-hmm. one per each per victim. The only connecting thread is the lonely women through the personal ads, and that's about it.
The fact that he watches TV and they always offer way too much information about the killer.
This was absurd.
Including,
this was really...
at one point, are you going to talk about the DNA?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, introducing nascent DNA technology, but also divulging details that the police would never... ever. Maybe they do things differently in Italy, but they say stuff which is highly speculative. And
so
this is,
much info over the airwaves.
Oh, as a journalist, it pained me to watch this, saying he's likely to be caught soon, and which is ridiculous. And then there's this constant thread of...
And they're talking about his appearance.
Yes,
and so he keeps taking his appearance. Yep, indeed.
And oh, he's has a beard and he has glasses, and then he adjusts his appearance accordingly.
He's got dark hair, so in the next scene, he dyes his hair blonde. But, to me, the most ridiculous one was, and now police have discovered his DNA type, which is, whatever, mono, blah, 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 blah. And Lester Parsons, the killer, is like, wait a second, that's my DNA type. Let me ask you a question, Chris. Do you know your DNA type?
I don't even know my blood type. So I hope
I barely know mine.
No.
Who the hell knows her DNA type? That was something.
I'm embarrassed to say this as someone who minored in biology, but I don't even know if I can name the blood types, apart from O and A. Is it A negative? B negative, B positive.
There's some negative and some positive, yeah. And that's
life.
It's like batteries,
yeah,
basically.
Exactly. I know for a fact there's no
positive.
C. That much I know. But yeah, this is just so crazy, and just the details released, and how he's the cliche. And whenever someone in a movie turns on the TV, it's always not a minute preceding a newscast, not 5 minutes preceding a newscast. It's always 5 seconds before their story that relates to them directly just pops right on. They have like a sixth sense of this ability to just pop up the news. And he was doing this repeatedly. Hilarious moments running throughout is this sort of voiceover of horse racing. And horse racing, I believe this is the first time we've talked about horse racing on the podcast.
Now, boxing is a sport of kings. Isn't
yes.
there, is there a certain sobriquet for horse racing? That
Not that I
no?
know.
Okay.
Bored of like people without a job in the middle of the day who can go to the track. Like, I don't know why anyone does this. It must be like boxing, like a dying sport, because I associate it with both the highest of the high elite one percenters and the lowest of the low unemployed degenerates with nothing in between. So the Queen's Plate, the Kentucky Derby on one end, and then the likes of the sad sacks that Charles Bukowski would
call. The off-track betting.
That's even worse.
Yeah.
There was an off-track betting near our respective residences, and it closed down. And I thought, like, I just imagine someone in a visor, like one of those golf visors and maybe a Hawaiian shirt with a gut who sits there and watches this with a rolled up newspaper, slamming it on the bar, going, come on, like hot to trot in the third. Like, I don't know, that's probably the name of 10,000 horses.
You're describing an overweight Hunter S. Thompson, basically.
Yeah, basically. horse racing, just very bizarre. But what I thought was funny, and I don't know if this is part of the what we've learned part of the podcast, I don't know if we've reached that yet, but he tries to earn back what I believe is $200,000 in gambling debt.
That's a princely sum.
That is incredible, to this bookie, and he tries to get in on this card game. And I was paying close attention to this movie. I may not know much about Brett Halsey. God love him. But
I don't know much, but I know I love him.
Oh, the Something Brothers. Who was that?
That was actually one of the Neville brothers. I believe it was Aaron.
The one with the thing on his face.
Yeah, the one with the mole on his face.
Yeah, okay. That ties into the moles on the breast.
Right, exactly. There's a kind of thread. That was a duet with Linda Ronstadt.
Ah.
I don't know much, but I know I love you.
Well, we know a lot in this podcast. I was paying close attention, and he tries to double his bet on this hand. I believe it's 10 or 20 grand on one hand. He has four of a kind kings. And so obviously he's all in because this is poker. But, and I don't know if this game was rigged, his combatant has... Everyone else folds and they have a flush. Yeah. So there are only two hands that could have beaten his hand. It would be four of aces, assuming aces are high, four of a kind aces, and a flush. So two hands, and it beats him, and damn, he is really in hock to these guys as he loses the hand, and he's even in worse state. There are only so many aging damsels that he could really approach to try and hawk their art, their fine art, or their jewelry. He's like, he has to come up with a better plan to accumulate 200 grand.
Well, I mean, the thing is, where are our, I was going to say hero, but where are... protagonist is lucky in terms of procuring aging divorcees and widowers. He's really unlucky in life. He's a real sad sack.
Yeah.
He's somebody that goes through life with like everything bad happened to him all at once. And even some of his methods of disposing of the victims end up becoming quite comical, quite farcical.
Oh, yeah. One in particular is a great scene where he goes to some quarry or construction site and the body does not fit in the car, so in the trunk, I almost said the boot, like the Brits, and so he saws off the legs so that they'll fit, as opposed to just, I don't know, bending the body at the knee, the rigor mortis already set in, so they can't, and he saws them off, and talk about being, you know, chopped off at the knees. He stuffs her into the trunk, brings her to this construction site, unloads her in this pit, and then drops some concrete into the hole. And this is all witnessed by some local
vagrant.
Vagrant. And this is like the one. This is an action-packed, atypical victim because all the vics are ingenues and aging ladies. And this is one sort of Geico caveman, bum-looking, you know, no fixed address hobo. He witnesses it, and Lester Parson sees that he's been caught.
Compromised. Yeah.
Compromised. In fact, I believe... the bum hides in his car and tries to blackmail him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he ends up running him over in this spectacular fashion in the middle of this Tuscan woods. It's supposed to be California, but whatever. It's clearly Tuscany.
Runs under the over Tuscan the sun, right?
Yes. Are there any places to stay in Tuscany? Ask Jerry Seinfeld. He runs over this bum five times with his car, backwards, forwards, puts it into reverse, like pops his melon like a melon.
French on melon, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And the guy survives just long enough to be able to give yet another description of the killer's visage to be rendered in a composite drawing again and run right immediately in the evening news. So that was very funny. There's no way anyone could survive that.
Well, one of the, I would say another theme of this film is, no pun intended, overkill. Mm-hmm. In the sense that every victim is killed over and over and over again, and a blow that would take out a mere mortal. I mean, these are like, you know, the
WWE wrestling.
I was gonna say, these are like the denizens of Eternia.
Oh, okay.
Like, you know, it takes forever to kill them.
Yeah,
yeah.
Although not in every case. Again, he's in one. Maybe it's a nod to his love of horse racing. He kills one with a riding crop, or some sort of horse whip, and she's dead in 2 seconds. Meanwhile, some of the other victims have all manner of trauma done to them, and they last for 20 minutes, seemingly at a time. Oh my God. This appeared at a time when Fulci's creative powers were fading, and you could attribute that to the changing milieu of the business at the time, direct to video affecting how he was doing business, antagonism toward the producers.
Yep. His finances were, his budgets were slashed.
Plus age.
Financial problems. He was beset by personal problems at the time. So and his creative powers were waning, and he wasn't. And he didn't have his collaborators that he had during his golden period.
Well, to say the least. I mean, I looked at the credits for this one, and I saw Angelo Mattei, who is best who's known for, and this is great, the makeup for Jim Cotta, as well as doing some of the set pieces for Demons, a movie with our mutual favorite.
Well, actually, the reason I laughed is, I mean, is he related to Bruno Mattei, or
I would say probably yes, because that's a rare enough name, and he certainly brings to his work the trademark indifference that his, you know, maybe his relative did with his directorial works. But he did not do the special effects for Demons, but he did some of the production pieces. So he was also involved in Cat in the Brain and that. So you could tell that had he been able to, Lucio Fulci would have turned to one of his, you know, more oft-used co-stars and collaborators in terms of the special effects department. Not to say this stuff was underdone or underwhelming.
The microwave murder might have been just slightly underdone, but
it was serviceable. But
no,
it was well done, to be honest with you. Well, okay, in that sense of the word, But compared with the, I mean, what was it, City of the Living Dead, that had the vomiting up of the entrails?
Or intestines, guts,
and
everything
protracted,
inside.
That was amazing. Upchucking her guts in splendid fashion. Or, of course, the iconic eye-gouging scene from Zombie. So it didn't have those kind of impact. It seemed like kind of stuff that would be ending up on the cutting room floor had it been in the golden period for the likes of New York Ripper and that kind of thing. So, but still, by anyone's standards, pretty cool, but not up to Fulci's standards. What did you learn?
Oh, I didn't even know that was the segment we were talking about.
That was a very long-winded description of what I learned.
What I learned is that, I guess, due to all the problems of Fulci and perhaps the Italian film industry were dealing with at the time, this film, although it was made in 1988, it wasn't released until 1991, and even then it was released straight to video. So it's interesting, though, how what a precipitous fall from grace that in 1981 he made one of the most atmospheric gothic horrors ever, The Beyond, and 7 years later he's making this Dreck.
Yes, and The Beyond, of course, with, Schweig, who was the artist who's holed up in this dilapidated Louisiana swamp mansion. That movie sits with me and has stuck with me for a long time. There's that odd scene, which I believe features Katrina McCall, with the German Shepherd walking down the middle of the road in this, I mean, so dreamscape, this surreal, odd, the dream logic sequence that is one for the ages, and then some of the great kills from that movie, and the flashback to the lynch mob that goes after Schweig, and the torches, and then the swamp, and the amazing visuals, and then this, which is, I mean, as cheap as anything he'd done really in that period, which is just inside some, I believe, a couple of homes probably in the outside of Rome, and really not much in the way of just knockout visual aesthetic, and really unique in that respect. And I think this was meant to be part of a series or part of something that he was meant to oversee, that was maybe a bunch of installments or kind of a small part of a larger feature, and he ended up taking over control of the whole of it. But there's really not much to warrant. I mean, even an 80-minute runtime, there's, again, a 10 to 15-minute scene of his trying to recoup his gambling losses through a card game, and then these elaborate drinking and dinner party sequences where he brings home some crustacean in a bag. I believe it's like crab or something, and I was under the impression he was going to cook it. Then he says to his paramour, okay, just sit tight, you know, I'm going to get this ready. And he pulls out some legs, and they're steaming right out of the bag. So leave it to Italy to be able to get, like, a la carte, on the go, ready to eat crab, and it was really bizarre.
No, right? Annie Hall that scene.
Right? No.
Well, the one thing I thought that you would glom onto this film and then you would enjoy is the whole unreliable narrator aspect of it all, because I know you always like that.
Oh, yeah. With respect to Lester Parson himself and what... I'm not sure to what extent, because he pretty much is mirrored and shadowed by his alter ego, and I thought there would be this great reveal at the end to show that this was his long-lost brother, or this was a they allude to a copycat who is doing some of, he thinks is doing his
because every time he thinks
deeds.
That he's gotten away with something, they find the body. So every time he thinks he's in the clear, somebody did something and something is found, so he thinks that somebody's copying him and killing the same people. It's a little weird.
It really is odd.
Convoluted.
And it makes no sense, I guess. Like, he is deemed such a catch, and really,
he's Bert Halsey. Come on, man.
He is.
Anybody that can be on The Young and the Restless opposite Eric, the great Eric Braeden as Victor Newman, is a catch.
Hey, I thought that I was going to ask you while I was watching it, like, is there an allusion to what he does for a living? Because it seems like he's just a professional gambler. But by his mien and by his demeanor and by his the way he carries himself, you would think he's a professional white-collar person. Like,
I think
maybe
he was.
Maybe he was.
But somebody who's now down in his luck, maybe it seems like he would be a widower himself or a divorcee. And he does have an ex-wife. Remember, there's a picture of his ex-wife on the...
Oh, my God. You're paying very, very close attention. Yeah. Meanwhile, I'm studying his... the hand that he's betting on and going all in. But yeah, and he puts on some Strauss waltzes to woo his paramours, and he brings them glasses of champagne and wine and tries to butter them up and sweet talks them, and he dances to himself in 3-4 times to these waltzes and
dances to himself or with himself.
Yeah, Billy Idol again.
Yeah, exactly.
Himself. Yeah, and he's very like debonair, but there's nothing to indicate why he would be so. And he doesn't, I mean, if he is so debonair, and if he is so charming, and if he is perceived to be rich, maybe he's down on his luck now, why is it that he can only pull, to use a British ism, pick up these dowdy women, first victim accepted? They're not lookers, and are some of them ladies of the evening, obliquely referenced, or are they just that, I don't understand how he ends up with like this mole boob woman, and with the mustache too. Like, that makes no sense.
I think it's just because they're meant to be women of means, they're meant to be money, and some of them are.
So is he like a gigolo? Like,
well, I mean, that's basically what he's trying to do. He's trying to
procure
these women.
Ooh, I gotta get me a hot young 60-year-old gigolo. I mean,
well, it's not like he's going for, you know, young girls. He's trying to procure women that have money, and
okay.
Are
we gonna throw Fulci a bone and say that he at least age appropriately paired victims and his antagonist? Good for him.
Lucio, you've been accused of misogyny over and over and over again. This was a credit to you. Good on you, man. Age appropriate paramours and victims.
Yeah, I find that interesting about the misogyny criticism levied against him, because it almost seems a de facto part of the genre when you have the bulk of killings and rapes and all that perpetrated by men, to the point where we could only maybe name on one hand infamous female killers. So it seems like a little bit unfair, because you're just really replicating what is, right? You're just showing what is. Maybe you can be accused of reveling in it too much. Maybe Argento would be accused more of, you know, trafficking in the spoils of killing and with his bloodletting and his beautiful bloodletting of gorgeous victims. I would say that would be fair.
Charges were levied against both of them for misogyny, but with Fulci there was also his behavior off camera, and he was notable for being really terrible to his female co-stars. When I interviewed Ian McCullough way back when at Horrorama, he said that he never witnessed such behavior, but the stories are legendary of Fulci just berating and abusing his female co-stars on set.
Yeah, well, I believe this is one instance where one of his leading ladies, he actually had kind things to say about. Oh God, what a horribly constructed sentence. But yeah, this Czech-born actress who plays one of the victims, like, they're few and far between. He had a problem with the bulk of his co-stars, and instead of keeping it to himself, would blab it, and whether it be on radio interviews or later used in Blu-ray commentaries. And it's kind of, I mean, you should keep that kind of dirty laundry to yourself, I think, to a certain extent in the business, as a lot of people have. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing to gain from that, especially with the power discrepancy between one of these sort of lesser known aging type of women who couldn't get more roles beyond Euro exploitation and this prominent, powerful,
patriarch. Power as the years went on, and unfortunately waning health as well. And this, is one of his, not his swan song, but getting pretty close to it. So star rating for Touch of Death.
I feel like my criticism up until now has belied my real enjoyment of this one. The score is hilarious. Use of, I think, the Strauss waltzes, his dancing is very funny. The ridiculous, and I think this speaks to the lack of budget, ridiculous replication of the 6 o'clock news or equivalent in Italy of this guy in a plaid suit with like a background behind him that wouldn't even fit like a Wayne's World public access television and him disclosing every detail the cops know and showing their hand, again an allusion maybe to the card game earlier, really making it easy for the killer to modify his appearance and get away with more. Then again, you could say that this killer paid particular attention to detail with all the news dispatches, and I liken it to a modern day BTK killer who would taunt the media with like a box of cereal as a serial killer. But meanwhile, this guy took such strict attention to the detail, he was almost like his own PR person, watching the news and being able to respond to it. And again,
well, to be fair, I mean, to Lester Parsons, this is Italy in the mid to late 80s,
where everyone would have had a mustache and glasses.
I mean, how many channels did they have? Maybe like five.
Yeah,
you know,
Rye one, Rye two, Rye three. Yeah, no, true.
So there's not much else to watch on the air.
Yeah.
So you know, if you're
another thing I've learned is really the police are not involved in this whatsoever.
No, actually, because, come to think
which
of
is, I mean, they would be par for the course. Introduced in a, let's say, a proper giallo from 75 to 79, where they would really at least become involved to introduce several ridiculous red herrings.
Exactly.
And then, come upon the killer through tons of engagement. Here, his killings are brought to a halt by someone you would not expect. So that was, and it seems a bit of a throwaway, but it is, I expected more from the denouement, I won't say more, but it was something I did not see coming. So a complete lack of police involvement.
Almost similar to Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer in that regard.
Oh, I would say so, yeah.
Who would have thought I would be bearing Touch of Death, the Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer?
Well, yeah, I would say that is in my top five all-time greatest slasher movies. This one, not so much. And
would this be in your top 5,000?
Ooh, definitely in the top 200.
Okay,
there
you go.
That. But I don't even know to what I could compare it, because really the only thing I would be familiar with is, let's say, the New York Ripper or that kind of, where, I mean, his M.O. was taunting the cops with the duck voice and everything through a payphone. But I can't think of other Fulci slasher films you could compare it to. So I don't even know if this.
He made a few like Murder Rock again, like in his late
in
period.
Swan Song.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is still incredibly enjoyable. And I get a kick out of horse racing. I've made a point of, because I went to journalism school at a college near a prominent racetrack in Toronto, and every year I think I say this, or I make a vow to go to the track, learn how to lay down a few bets and see what it's all about, because I think there's probably something rather noble about it in some way, and I've always interested in experiencing new things, and I thought, okay, it can't be as pathetic as I envision it, and I've always wanted to go to the Kentucky Derby again because of Hunter S. Thompson and his famous essay, The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved, where everyone's sort of corralled into this one like tented area where everyone wears these
ridiculous hats
that they wear usually in for parties to celebrate, I don't know, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge or something. So you have all these people dressed at the nines and drinking mint juleps, which is a drink I really like. So I would love to experience horse racing in some capacity, and this movie made me want to reiterate my commitment. Maybe that'll be a 2020 thing. Maybe I'll bring you along and we'll put on our visors and our shades and we'll
and
like
our Hawaiian shirts.
Yes,
and we'll have like, our form yeah, rolled up.
Those stupid forms and then the pencil that yep. they give you to fill in your bets. It's so. It's such an antiquated.
And we'll be taking our tickets and ripping them up. son of a bitch! I lost again.
Damn you! Whatever you know, Sunset Horizon for losing in the fifth, and he's, curses to
he's
you.
He's a mutter. His mutter was a mutter. Whatever. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know anything about him, but yeah, I'm gonna give this a solid 3 because the kills and the set pieces. For all the lack of any sort of action in between, there's some quality kills, and the way he charms, to use the term loosely, and beds his victims and seduces them, not exactly of Dustin Hoffman level, you're trying to seduce me here, but it's fun. He goes to the kitchen, he preps dinners, pours champagne, offers aperitifs, cooks crustaceans. He makes a go of it. He makes an effort. He's a playboy.
Yeah.
Not to the extent of American Psycho, but he tries. And this is a fun movie. It is ridiculous. If you didn't tell me it was Fulci, I would
you
not
wouldn't
have known.
It was Fulci.
No.
No way. Yeah.
And you can't. I mean, the golden era, you can you know juggle them and put whatever you want as number one. I vacillate between, I think, Zombie and City of the Living Dead. And then the
See,
Beyond.
For me, it's the Beyond all the way.
Oh, okay, yeah. I think Zombie, just because it was one of my
and
first.
And don't forget House by the Cemetery as well.
Ooh,
yeah.
Damn, yeah. Oh, that's good too. But you gotta love like the gates of hell opening up and the priest and the dead priest swinging from the tree and
yep.
it's like, oh my god, man, that is a great movie too. Okay, man, they're like. You know, you can't Sophie's Choice any of them, really.
Right.
I hold Zombie in very high regards. That's my first. I was 17. But I think, I think City of Living Dead and The Beyond would eclipse that for sure. In terms of pure visual style, The Beyond takes it all the way. But for the kills, oh my God, we could wax poetic about his work.
Well, it's funny because about this particular piece of work, I was going to give it 2.5 stars. I did find it to be, in certain scenes, a little bit mean-spirited, a little bit unpalatable.
When he kicks the cat?
I didn't like the cat kicking scene. But your enthusiasm is swaying me, and I'm going to...
It's a fun movie.
It is,
I mean,
it is a fun movie. I think I just have to be in the right frame of mind to watch it. And this was not my first viewing. I probably loved it more on my first viewing. I probably thought it was a riot, but this one I was a little bit more critical. But at the same time, your enthusiasm is buoying my star rating,
Ooh.
So I'm now giving it 3 stars.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to... I mean, we're going to eventually cover all the iconic, trio of Mount Rushmore of Italian horror demigods. I mean, we're going to cover
Argento,
your Babas. And,
Fulci, Baba.
Yeah, there's
yep.
so much material to tread on. I think, if anything, we've given Argento the short shrift because I've been prodding you to do opera and Profondo Rosso and all these kinds of films.
I just don't know if we can do those films justice. I really don't. We did do Phenomena, though.
Yeah.
And we did Inferno.
Yeah.
We've done a couple of Argentos.
Yeah, I think Inferno is a little bit easier than... I mean, I think opera would be the toughest, and I think I would have to bone up on, some of the iconic
Deep Red would be
Italian operas. That would be fantastic.
Yep.
And we hope to bring you more of these and other genre stalwarts on the Really Awful Movies podcast. Upload if you're listening pleasure every Friday, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.